Well, on several occasions, I've heard reports, you probably have too, that millennials are not as committed to the automotive lifestyle as certainly as baby boomers, but maybe other demographic segments is as well. So a headline in today's Free Press kind of jumped out at me here. This is a story from Chris Woodyard at USA Today. Headline, Millennials Go Big for Ford SUVs. Not the headline I was expecting to read this morning. And Chris Woodyard reports that Ford has made an interesting discovery. Its midsize Ford Explorer, not the compact Escape. That's another part of the narrative here, I guess. If millennials are going to buy an SUV, it's going to be a more compact SUV, a smaller vehicle. But Ford is learning that its midsize Ford Explorer, not the compact Escape, is the most popular SUV it offers for buyers ages 25 to 34. You think you know something, and then you find out something that turns it on its ear. Its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program, a trio of MSU researchers gathered yesterday in Lansing to discuss aspects of the Flint water crisis. In its monthly public policy forum, the university's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research gave guest speakers a chance to discuss the responsibilities of state and local governments in addressing the water emergency, as well as the work being done regarding the health of Flint residents. Current State spoke with two of the guest speakers. First, Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, who's become renowned as a whistleblower in the Flint crisis. She also heads the recently launched Pediatric Public Health Initiative involving MSU and Flint's Hurley Hospital. I first asked Dr. Hanna Atisha where the health initiative is right now.
It is running full speed ahead, actively building a plane while we're flying it. So we have lots of research initiatives that already are underway to continue the assessment of the exposure. We're already doing a lot of community-based work in regards to the interventions. And we're already starting to identify kind of our cohort of kids and doing the baseline developmental assessment. So we are full speed ahead with many interdisciplinary folks working on this initiative and what's best for our kids.
Remind us of its long-term goals here, Its broader goals.
Yeah, so the goal of the Michigan State University Hurley Children's Health Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative is really to flip the story. It is a reinvestment in our children because of this lead issue so that they do have brighter tomorrows, and it's a collaboration with community. It's a collaboration with tons of experts from different disciplines, both at Hurley and at MSU, and it's a collaboration with government. So we are all hoping to work together to build a model public health program to build a center of excellence so that our kids do not see the consequences of lead poisoning.
You stressed three particular features of the program: assessments, right, monitoring, and intervention, and you really stressed the intervention. Are you conducting interventions now?
Absolutely. So every week at the farmers market, we do cooking classes that are lead-focused for the community. This is an intervention to teach people about the importance of nutrition and the importance of a lead-mitigated diet. Just yesterday, we had 12,000 gallons of milk donated by the Michigan dairy farmers as an intervention because kids need calcium. They don't just need water. So we are doing lots of different interventions right now, and we have many in the planning stages on how to buffer the children from the impacts.
Talk to us some more about wanting to flip the story. What exactly do you mean there?
So our families, all they're hearing are sound bites. They're hearing brain damage. They're hearing irreversible neurotoxin. And they're feeling that their children are hopeless, that everybody's given up on them, and that they're a throwaway children, and this is a throwaway city. And this is what we're flipping. We are providing hope. We are providing the resources through many partners to change that sound bite so that these children are smart, they are beautiful, they're resilient, and they are going to have bright futures, and it's not a population that we've given up on.
I'm talking with Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha of the MSU Hurley Hospital Initiative here. You picked up some high-profile support recently. Actor Mark Ruffalo, Sandra Bernhardt. Can you tell us about their contributions?
Absolutely. So Mark Ruffalo actually came and spent the whole day in Flint. He came to the hospital. He's actually a water activist. He listened. The most important thing, he did listened. He listened to what was going on, and he used his profile to share the story nationally, because everybody needs to hear the Flint story. Everybody in the country needs to know what happened to Flint and what we need to do to move forward, because it's, you know, like I said earlier, it's not a political issue. It's become a political issue, but it's not a political issue. It's not a partisan issue. This is a humanitarian issue, and everybody needs to hear the Flint story. So if these famous folks can help share that story, we are grateful to them.
How closely are you following the activity in Washington, the testimony of the various officials before the House Oversight Committee?
Right.
Do you have time to follow that?
I listened to it on live stream in the car yesterday, so I was able to hear some snippets.
Any response to what you heard?
I think it's great that the House Oversight Committee has taken this up. I think investigations are important. The city of Flint needs accountability to move forward. It's almost like a truth and reconciliation process. They need to know the truth. They need to know what happened so that they can begin to heal. And if these investigations are going to get at that truth, then so be it. And, you know, I support them. But hopefully it just doesn't become a blame game. Oh, he did it. This fault. We need to know what happened so that we can prevent another Flint.
I'm at the head of a long line here, so I'll wrap up. You're a relatively young pediatrician, it seems to me, who's playing a key role in Flint. Do you expect to spend the rest of your career in Flint? Do you expect to spend the rest of your career dealing with what you're dealing with now?
This is definitely my job now, and this is my mission, and this is why I wake up in the morning, is to do this work. And it's my commitment and to ensure that these kids have a brighter future, and so be it for now and for decades to come.
Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha is Director of Pediatric Residency at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint and Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at MSU's College of Human Medicine. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Also yesterday, I sat down with Michigan State Political Science Professor Joshua Sapochny. He shared the results of a study that looked at another aspect of Flint, the intricacies of state government's roles in financial emergencies. It involves the historic challenges Flint was already facing and its emergency management status. Sapochny claims misguided policy leads to problems, in particular for Michigan cities.
The mix of policies puts expenditure side pressures on local governments. So, for instance, a mandate, whether it's funded or potentially underfunded, right? This is something that the state requires local governments to do. Sometimes they're given the requisite resources to accomplish that from the state government. Sometimes they're not. Those types of pressures on local governments to take on certain issues and spend money in a certain way, right? That balanced against revenue side limitations. So, how vibrant is the aid environment that states would provide to local governments via revenue sharing or via other programs? And also the types of revenue and the amount of revenue that that state governments sort of essentially allow local governments to take on. So the mix of those different policies and different sort of institutional structures has varying degrees of financial pressure on local governments. When you sort of quantify this and you put it all together and you rank order the 50 states, it turns out that it really is very challenging to be a city in the state of Michigan, particularly with respect to, you know, your ability to manage your fiscal affairs.
And on the back end, you took a look at for example, you took a look at Michigan's emergency manager law, and you compare that with the laws that exist in other states for dealing with municipalities that are under some kind of financial distress. What did you find out from your exploration of these emergency manager type laws?
The main question there was, can we sort of capture the approach or the logic of a state, of the way that the states kind of define the nature of the problem, the problem being local financial distress or even an emergency, and try to get a sense systematically of how that logic, right, how that's manifested in the state's approach, in the state's policy. And so it turns out that there's about around 20 states that have an emergency manager type or a takeover type policy on the books. Around half of them actually seem to use the authority that's granted to the state to actually exercise that authority and use it to intervene in local governments. And it turns out that Michigan's policy is representative of one sort of type or one bucket of policies that focuses mostly on takeover. So you appoint one individual, that individual is granted a whole, for lack of a better word, dictatorial powers to run the city in the way that the manager sees fit. So there's that kind of approach, Michigan's approach, and Michigan's sort of the prototype for this approach. And you can contrast that with other states like maybe Pennsylvania or New Jersey that have more of a kind of a bottom-up approach. What distinguishes these two types of approaches is really how much the policy incorporates the preferences, formally incorporates the preferences of local officials when key decisions are being made. In Pennsylvania, New Jersey, right, more of a kind of a board structure where there's multiple actors, and some of those actors are local officials, right? The local officials are still empowered to make decisions. They're working with state appointees to try to work their way through these fiscal challenges. You know, contrast that with Michigan's approach, where it's one individual, that individual sort of takes over the city, runs the city, with, and frankly, with very limited staff and with very limited support. So, you know, you can sort of see how the logic kind of manifests itself there. In Michigan, in the case of Michigan, it's the local screwed up. We're going to send one person in to clean house and get the city right again. In Pennsylvania, these are really challenging problems. One type of issue the local governments face is issues of corruption, issues of mismanagement, issues of dysfunction, political dysfunction at the local level. But they face a whole range of issues, a whole bunch of reasons why local governments are facing these sort of intractable financial challenges. Mismanagement is just one of them. And so, you know, our approach is more to sort of work with local governments in more of a partnership approach to try to help them dig their way out of this hole.
There are no doubt some listeners hearing this who think Michigan's emergency manager law, in order to dig a municipality out of a deep hole, you've got to have some concentrated authority. That's what's required in order to dig a municipality out of a hole like that. How do you respond to that? And does Pennsylvania's approach, does a more moderate approach, does it tend to work?
So that's an excellent question, and it's something that we're actually currently working through right now. We're writing about right now. I think an example is worthwhile here. So Allen Park in Michigan. Allen Park, for folks who haven't followed this as closely, sunk a lot of resources into a film studio deal, and that essentially sunk them. They went into financial emergency. They went into Michigan's takeover protocol, and one individual was appointed. And in a year to 18 months, they were basically back in the black. They had their budget was balanced. They worked their way through the issue. In that context, a takeover is completely appropriate. It makes a ton of sense. The problem in Michigan is that there are a heck of a lot more Flints and Benton Harbors and Detroits and Highland Parks than there are Allen Parks. So the reasons why these local governments are in a financial emergency, one of those reasons is mismanagement and dysfunction. But that's one of a whole variety of issues, right? What we're calling for here is flexibility in the way that the state thinks about these problems. Sure, having, as you said, some centralized authority, that makes a lot of sense. It makes sense in certain contexts. You know, what we're saying here is that it's one size fits all, you know, never works out. What's the problem with working a little more closely with local lawmakers to try to sort of help them manage their way through these crises as opposed to displacing them and essentially running the city for 18 months?
We want to thank Joshua Sapochny, MSU Assistant Professor of Political Science. He has been talking with us about the results from his Mott Foundation-funded study on the role of state government, specifically in Flint management, but it shed a lot of light on state and local management dynamics here. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders claimed victory in Michigan's presidential primary, but that has not stopped some third-party contenders from bringing their issues to the Great Lakes state. On Saturday, in fact, the U.S. Taxpayers Party of Michigan is hosting a presidential debate in Lansing featuring the party's four national candidates. We'll talk with the party's Michigan chairman, Bill Moore, about what third parties bring to the political dialogue. That's on the way. The tracks of my tears. Stop in the name of love. You better shop around. What's your favorite Motown song? It's hard to choose, isn't it? You'll hear dozens of chart toppers in Motown the Musical, now through Sunday at the Wharton Center. The show features many favorites from Hitsville, USA, while telling the story of Detroit's emergence as a cultural powerhouse and stage for social change. Jesse Nager sings the role of Smokey Robinson. He joined WKAR's Peter Wharf in our studio yesterday to talk about Motown the Musical. Nager's a Boston native with a strong Michigan connection. He's a graduate of the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, training that prepared him well for a run at Broadway.
Michigan is an incredible program, and I think what they really excel at is preparing students to audition and how to get jobs and how to feel comfortable in an audition setting, because it's tough. And you know, you start to go inside your mind and you start to think about all these things. What should I be doing? And they really sort of give you the skill set to approach auditions in a really comfortable manner.
How does that happen? What do they do?
They let you know how to feel comfortable in yourself, I think. And the more comfortable you are walking into the room, having prepared the material, the more likely you are to get cast, because the auditioning people, they like you. They feel at ease if you feel at ease. So they just give you all of the things you need to learn to sort of be as comfortable as you can.
Do you find that building up that experience of doing many auditions helps in auditioning?
Absolutely. And, you know, the more you audition, the more you know about yourself, what you're going to be like in the room, what they're going to expect in the room. And also, you start meeting people and you start knowing people. And so the casting directors that were once foreign to you are now friendly to you because you know them. They've seen you in the room 1,000 times. So everyone's sort of a little bit more calm and at ease.
What have you learned about yourself as an auditioner and as a performer from preparing for and auditioning?
One of the biggest things that I learned is that I'm a person that is always inside of my head, and I'm always thinking about what I could have done or what I should have done. And the biggest thing that I learned was, once you leave the audition room, let it go. There's nothing you can do anymore at that point. Once you've left the room, it doesn't matter what you've done in the room. It doesn't matter whether you should have sang this note or made this choice. It's over. So just sort of let it go. If you get a call back, great. You can sort of revisit the stuff. But once you've left the room, let it go.
Stay in the moment.
Stay in the moment.
Well, talk about preparing to be Smokey Robinson. What did you do?
Lots of YouTube. YouTube footage. Another really cool thing is that he's a real person, right? So you get to see interviews that he's done, and you get to make choices based on things that he's actually done in his life. Also, we get to meet him and his friends and his family, and Berry Gordy, who is his best friend, and they give you tons of insight as well. And so you get to make decisions based on this inside knowledge that everyone has.
To you? What has Smokey Robinson said to you about
it? He loves it. He loves this show, and he calls me Little Smokey. That's his nickname for me. He's just such a supporter of his best friend, Berry Gordy, so he's always just so comfortable. And actually, one technical thing is, you know, when I first started, I was doing his voice a little bit higher pitched than sort of, you know, I was sort of talking like here, and he said, you know, the thing is, my voice isn't actually that high.
The speaking voice.
The speaking voice, right. It's just breathy. Right. So you don't have to, you know, pitch it that high. You can, if you lean into the breath, it's a more authentic sound, which I thought was pretty cool.
Fantastic.
I had started the album, really, and there are two or three cuts on the album that I had already recorded myself, production-wise. And I took them up just casually one day to Barry Gordy's house, and as I do a lot of times, and I let him hear it, and he said, "Smoke, that's garbage, man."
Your boss, your long friend for 30 years said, "That's garbage." Your work. Did you punch him in the mouth?
No, because I know he said that because he loves me. See, it was constructive criticism, and we've always had that.
I'm speaking with Jesse Nager. He plays Smokey Robinson in Motown the Musical, which is playing through March 20th at the Wharton Center here in East Lansing. I'm most interested, of course, in Motown the Musical's great music, but running parallel is a story of a great history. Motown the Musical, as you mentioned, tells the story of producer Berry Gordy's journey and how the Motown sound was able to break down barriers.
Absolutely.
Musically, socially. Can you tell about what that means to you and sort of some of that story that we'll see?
You know, it's incredible because you think of Motown and you think of the music, but it really was, as you said, really important in desegregating audiences. I mean, there was so much integration in the Motown tour, the Motortown Review, as it was called in the 50s and 60s, would go down to the South where everything was segregated. It was really the first time that audiences sort of came together because this music was so fantastic and so powerful and so moving that everybody loved it.
Hey baby, what you know good? I'm just getting back, but you knew I would. War is hell. When will it end? When will people start getting together again? Are things really getting better, like the newspapers said? What else is new, my friend, besides what I read? Can't find no work, can't find no job, my friend. Money is tighter than it's ever been. Say, man, I just don't understand what's going on across this land. Oh,
what's happening, brother?
Yeah, what's happening? What's happening, my friend?
And it really did break down a lot of walls. And, you know, it was also, once they started getting on television shows, you know, they were some of the first, the Supremes, the Temptations were some of the first black acts to get on television shows. And it really was a way for white America to see black America as they've never seen them before. And it was so important to the history of this country.
Yeah, when you think about segregation, we immediately maybe think of schools, yeah, of places of worship,
of
places to eat,
yeah,
but you had segregated record labels,
yep,
segregated radio stations.
Yeah. And it was really important for Berry Gordy to make sure that his music was played on all radio stations, and it was a fight. I mean, he had to fight, and he kept on pushing. Mm. And finally, you know, some of these DJs said, you know what, this music is great. I should play some of this. And it just, you know, from there it took off.
You got to tell me, what are the songs that you sing?
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand.
I sing most of his earlier stuff in the show. Got a Job, Shop Around, You've Really Got a Hold on Me, and I sing Cruisin' towards the end too.
Nice. Jesse Nager plays Smokey Robinson in Motown the Musical at the Wharton Center through March 20th. Jesse, thanks a lot for being
absolutely
on Current State.
Thanks.
Appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
Cruising is made for love.
Coming up on Current State, the Jackson Symphony Orchestra will bring some of the greatest hits from opera this weekend to the Potter Center. We'll speak with Maestro Stephen Osmond about this weekend's program, plus learn more about how this concert is also an audition for a hopeful conductor. That and more coming up on Current State. For you on St. Patrick's Day, performed by harpist Brittany DeYoung here in Studio S earlier this year, the perfect accompaniment for today. Tomorrow, our Live Music Friday guest will be singer Stephanie Hapala. She has a Friday night concert at the Loft in Lansing and is releasing a new EP entitled This Won't Be the Last Time I Tell You. This won't be the last time I... Okay. Stephanie Hapala, tomorrow, on Live Music Friday. We hope you can join us. It's Current State here on WKAR East Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. Trump, Sanders, Cruz, Clinton, and Kasich. There are now five mainstream presidential candidates still standing after key primaries this week in five states. Here's a few more names for you. Briggs, Diamond, Heffling, well, of course, and Matkin. Have you been following their campaigns? Chances are you haven't. These are four candidates from the U.S. Taxpayers Party, also known as the Constitution Party, but they will be here in Lansing on Saturday to hold their own presidential debate at a local restaurant, Tony M's. Third parties generally don't attract much attention in American politics, but that does not deter them from getting their issues in front of voters. Joining me to talk about third-party politics is Bill Moore. He is the chairman of the U.S. Taxpayers Party here in Michigan. Mr. Moore, glad to have you aboard today.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us a little bit about the U.S. Taxpayers, which, as we said, is also known as the Constitution Party. What would you say are some of your party's key positions?
Well, our key positions is we are opposed to abortion. We are pro-life, believe that life begins at conception. One of the key points in our platform is that we recognize God's help or God's influence in the development of American politics and America. We credit our freedoms, as does our state constitution, to the hand of God. We are also pro-traditional marriage, and we agree with the fathers in the principles that they developed. We find it amazing that our forefathers developed and engineered America, and our current politicians can't so much as maintain it.
Where do you, I mean, do your candidates end up taking positions on other issues as well, the economy, immigration, terrorism? Do they tend to weigh in across the board on all of the major issues?
Oh, absolutely. And much more of that will be seen on Saturday. And that'll all be taped. It's going to be produced, and you'll be able to find it on YouTube.
All right. Now, your organization is hosting this debate on Saturday. This is at Tony M's, featuring four candidates. Are these all candidates for president?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All presidential candidates. We'll point out one of them is from Michigan, by the way, Richard Matkin of Hazel Park. What do the candidates hope to gain by holding this event after our state's primary?
Well, what we do is we put quality candidates on the ballot. I mean, look at what America wants. They accuse the big parties of deceit and corruption. All politicians are evil, you know, we know that. And so the U.S. Taxpayers Party and our candidates, we put a lot of sweat, blood, and tears into getting on the ballot. We want to present the voters good candidates. It's up to the voters whether or not they want them in office, but they're there. Mm-hmm. They're there for your consideration. And I'll guarantee you, you elect any one of these four candidates, and you're going to have a far greater president than anything we see on the major party ballots.
What do you think third parties bring to the national dialogue? Do you feel, I mean, I assume you must think they're pretty relevant here, as you're committed to this party. What do you think broadly third parties, what do you think they bring to the landscape here?
Well, I'll tell you what, I told somebody this week, I honestly believe that we are looking at the end of the relevance of the Republican Party in this election. And whether or not Donald Trump wins this nomination, the Republican Party might take it away from him through a brokered convention. There's a multitude of things could happen here.
Do you think we're seeing the seeds of a third party movement?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Gallup poll has run a poll for a number of years, and where they ask people the question, do you want a third party option? And 52% to 54, sometimes up to 56% of the American people want a third party. Now, the problem is when it comes to the polls in November, they get scared, they get nervous, they vote out of fear, and they end up voting for a lesser of two evils instead of the right candidate, which you'll find on a third-party ballot.
The interesting thing there, though, is, I mean, if a third party were to emerge, I mean, I think the narrative, the way it's unfolding here, is it would probably be a more moderate wing of the Republican Party, which probably wouldn't please you. I mean, you're a very conservative guy. You'd be left with... Where would that leave you? Where would the formation of a third party leave a guy like you, who's a devotee of the Taxpayers Party?
Okay, I'm not sure you're correct in saying that a third party option would be more moderate, or a new third party.
Well,
rather.
I hear about Mayor Bloomberg, for example, and him getting involved. And, you know, obviously
right.
What we're seeing here is the split between the so-called establishment GOP and kind of the outsider wing, frequently the more conservative wing, represented by perhaps Ted Cruz, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would happen if Donald Trump and Michael Bloomberg got together? Time will tell that. I have no way to predict that. But I am getting a lot of phone calls and emails from frustrated Republicans, conservative Republicans, saying we've had it. We're through with the Republican Party, especially if they hold a brokered convention and usurp the will of the people. And we're looking for a place to go. And our party's growing right now. We picked up a number of new members, new supporters along the way. We've got people interested in this debate like I've never seen before. Go ahead.
We're talking with about the contributions third parties bring to American political politics. We're talking with Bill Moore. Mr. Moore's chairman of the U.S. Taxpayers Party of Michigan, which is hosting a debate among four of his party's presidential candidates this Saturday at Tony M's in Lansing. There must be some overlap between your party's positions and certainly in Senator Cruz. In any given election, are there candidates that appear that you are tempted to vote for?
I'll be honest, I haven't had one in a long time. And our party folks feel the same way I do. There's a couple of folks that like Trump and are talking about Trump, but when it comes right down to it, Trump doesn't have what it takes. He's about Trump. He's not about us. Ted Cruz, Trump is right about one thing. Ted Cruz is not eligible to be president because he was born in Canada, and I challenge anybody to dig into that and find the truth about that. You'll discover my statement is correct. Whether or not Cruz is a good senator, we could debate that another day, but the fact is that he's not able to discern or understand the Constitution correctly. How can we vote for him as president?
We will point.
I did vote in the primaries this year, but I did not vote for Ted Cruz. He's not eligible.
May I ask who you did vote for?
you can ask.
We'll leave it at that.
Here, you want it? I'll tell you. I have no secrets. I can't vote for Trump. Cruz is not eligible. Rubio is not eligible. I was left with John Kasich. I can't vote for Hillary or Bernie Sanders.
Understood.
I had to vote for Kasich. He's the only eligible.
We'll point out there are four U.S. Taxpayers Party's candidates who will be at Tony M's in Lansing on Saturday, one of them from Michigan, Richard Matkin. We want to thank our guest, Mr. Bill Moore, who is chairman of the U.S. Taxpayers Party of Michigan, hosting that debate for four of his presidential candidates this Saturday in Lansing. Mr. Moore, thank you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Well, if we're lucky, our memories are mostly of happy times and not too many regrets, but that's definitely not the case for the protagonist in Sebastian Falk's new novel. Here's Scott Southard with his review of Where My Heart Used to Beat.
Is it possible to really understand another person? That's a question that's puzzled everyone from scientists to philosophers for centuries. But while understanding the motivations and feelings of the people around you can seem impossible, sometimes the hardest person to know is actually yourself. That is definitely true for Robert Hendricks. He is the main character in Sebastian Falk's new novel, Where My Heart Used to Beat. Even he knows there is something missing from his solitary existence. Robert has been avoiding his past for most of his adult life. Whether it's his time fighting in World War II, his lost love, or his deceased parents, Robert seems to push away all of his painful memories. But in the end, his past will be the key to finding happiness again. Falk's fantastic novel starts out in the 1980s, when Robert is already in his 60s. There is little endearing about his very humdrum personality. Robert never really commits to friends or relationships. He keeps people at an arm's length and solicits prostitutes just so he can feel something. Years seem to slip by him, and even he is surprised at the older man he sees reflected in the mirror. The funny thing is that Robert's personal life is so different from his public persona. To the world, he is a groundbreaking psychiatrist and insightful writer. People seek out his books to help them navigate their own lives. Robert just doesn't seem very good at taking his own advice. But then an invitation arrives that changes everything. Alexander Pereira is another famous psychiatrist. He is in his 90s and looking for someone to carry on his life's work. He believes Robert is that person and invites him to visit his home on a small French island. He doesn't just choose Robert because of his reputation as a brilliant psychiatrist. He also has a personal connection to Robert's family, having fought alongside his father, who died during World War I. When Robert finally arrives on the island, it isn't quite what he expected. All Alexander can talk about is Robert's own life. He gets Robert to open up like never before. The formerly closed-off and aloof psychiatrist lays bare his memories of his love and adventures. It is then that the story starts to bloom into something interesting. We are transported to the battlefield scenes Robert experienced as a soldier during World War II. We follow him to Africa and the invasion of Italy in 1943. Falk's imagery is so vivid that you can almost smell the blood and mud permeating the air. While Robert is taking some time off after an injury, he meets a beautiful young woman named Louisa. While the injuries of war leave Robert with physical scars, it is the loss of Louisa that leaves the biggest mark on his life. Where My Heart Used to Beat sometimes feels like a window into a private therapy session. As Robert reveals more of himself to Alexander, he starts to experience and enjoy his life for the first time in years. He finds meaning outside of himself by reaching out to other struggling veterans. The word I kept thinking of while reading this book was fragile. The traumatic events of his past have broken Robert into pieces. But like Alexander Pereira, I found it so satisfying to put the puzzle of Robert Hendricks back together. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott Southard is the author of the novels Permanent Spring Showers and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writing via his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard, at sdsouthard.com. This weekend, the Jackson Symphony goes operatic in a program with some of the great arias, duets, and trios, with Michigan-based vocalists. Current State's Jamie Paisley visited with longtime maestro Stephen Osmond and joins me now. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there, Mark. It's always nice, you know, to speak vocalist to vocalist with maestro Stephen Osmond. It's one of those things that we connect on, and what I mean by that is that most of the music that he and I train for, there is that added degree of difficulty or ease, depending on who you ask, because vocal music typically has one thing that other musicians don't have to deal with: words.
It's all about music that really expresses, you know, human emotions. And I think music that's associated with texts have a special insight into the composer. I mean, there's no doubt about, you know, there's programmatic music that follows a certain story. But when a composer's got words that he's, you know, putting notes to, it's pretty clear what he's intending. And it's just a wonderful, more direct communication, I feel, that the performers get to have with the composer when they know exactly what he's saying, even though it's in a foreign language. And in some cases, you know, the texts are brilliant. Other cases, like the Wagner, they're a little bit less brilliant, let me say. But the music is, you know, exquisite. You just can't help but understand exactly what's going on. But it's interesting with the text and operas, especially when you convert a play to an opera. But so many plays have been very poorly transposed to an opera stage or a musical theater stage. We're doing something from You'll Never Walk Alone, for instance, which is obviously a Broadway colossal hit.
And a translation from a play as well, the Lilliane play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, but it's like a movie. If you go to a film or you watch it on TV and something, you know, really dramatic, and you turn off the volume and don't listen to the music, it's like, what are they doing there already? I mean, but then you turn the music back on, and it's just, you know, such an enhancement.
We're speaking with Maestro Stephen Osmond of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra, and we're talking about this Saturday's concert, Music and the Word. The concert primarily dealing with vocal music, namely opera, with selections like Musetta's Waltz from Puccini's La Bohème, which may be, aside from perhaps a couple by Strauss, the most famous waltz of all time.
But that's, again, a different kind of love being expressed between a young lady and her sugar daddy. So I would not really like to dance to it, but it's...
He might. The sugar daddy might.
Yes. I mean, we did that here. We had a wonderful sugar daddy. He was so funny.
In the first half of the concert, you're ending with two instrumental works with a guest conductor, Matthew Aubin. It sticks out a bit that something is a little different with those two non-vocal selections.
Yes, this will be the sixth guest conductor we've had to transition to a new music director. I'm going to retire at the end of next year. I'm very much looking forward to that. After 40, it'll be 40 years, and I think that's, you know, pretty good stint for one job. But We had originally had five, and then a surgeon moved to town, and we found out they had a her husband was a conductor, and a very good one. He's got his doctorate degree. He has an orchestra in Chelsea, New York, not Michigan, but Chelsea, New York. But we decided since he was here, we would expand the search and include him. And we didn't have a whole concert to give him like we did the others, but I think the audience, the orchestra, will get a chance to, you know, see how good a fit that might be.
That is one of the Polovtsian dances by Alexander Borodin, which you can see potential future Jackson Symphony music director Matthew Aubin conduct this Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. It'll be Aubin's public audition to take the baton, possibly, from Maestro Stephen Osman, who will be stepping down from the podium next season, and we're speaking with now.
Before that, we're featuring our principal violist, Clyde McCaney, a Jackson boy, raised, trained, and returned to. And he's doing the first movement of the Bloch Hebraic Rhapsody. And again, another very powerful piece, but without words. But I think, you know, the audience's imagination can't help but be drawn down a very profound and serious direction, which this piece represents.
There is one piece that we haven't talked about yet, and that's the famed male duet.
Oh, the Pearlfishers duet. I mean, that's one of those pieces. I think I first heard it when I was about 18 with Robert Merrill and Richard Tucker. And that was, and then followed by Domingo and Milnes, followed by, you know, it just goes down the line.
It's hard to go wrong with it.
Oh, yeah. It's just one of the things that we're really treating the audience to in this concert is we're giving, it's sort of like, you know, the 10 greatest operatic Broadway hits in, you know, an hour and a half instead of sitting through, you know, and that's, I don't mean to be unkind, but the Pearlfishers, and they've resurrected it recently. And just, you know, it's a lot of music. Sometimes it doesn't go anywhere, but by the time it gets to the duet, it's well worth the wait. So we're really condensing it, and Rosenkavalier is a very long, beautiful opera, very long, but there's not a, you know, a section to it that's any better than, in my opinion, than that trio at the end.
And the advantage of that is you can then highlight many more performers and the showiest bits.
Right, and it's, you know, presenting it as a concert, you don't feel so guilty about not having costumes and lighting and all those rather expensive elements that go into a fully staged opera. So this is not the primary consideration, but it helps in the end to not have to worry about all those other...
If you need the costumes, then just invite the audience to wear them instead.
well, that would be good. especially Sieg Linda would love to see some of what people would interpret that costume to be. But on the other hand, a Musetta costume could be very exciting indeed. I've always had a very strong stable of singers that I've known from all the places I've worked and studied, actually. It's several from Yale when I was a graduate student there. But now most of those have retired or weren't some of them weren't available. But I have found through other sources, Tim Cheek from the University of Michigan, the coach over there. And anytime I need a singer for something, I call him and say, I need a blop, dot, dot, dot. And he's been very helpful in finding me young talent, two of them from Michigan on this concert.
Maestro Stephen Osmond of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra speaking about this Saturday's concert titled Music and the Word, focusing upon some of the vocal masterpieces of opera with a sprinkling of Broadway and spirituals as well, and also highlights local Michigan singers. Not to mention guest Matthew Albin conducting two works in a live audition that might just allow him to take over for Maestro Stephen Osmond upon his stepping down from the podium next season. More information about the Jackson Symphony's concert this Saturday at the Potter Center can be found online at jacksonsymphony.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today, Friday on Current State. How about a stack of pancakes? Since it's maple syrup season, we visit the Fenner Nature Center in Lansing to learn what it takes to make a bottle of real maple syrup. Don't forget, we're going to be at the Broad Art Museum a week from today for our next pop-up stories. Come by between 6 and 7:30 p.m. for stories about having a lucky break. And if you want to sign up to be one of our storytellers, we invite you to do that. We'd love to have you. Email us at currentstate@wkar.org. Hope you can join us tomorrow. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Don't forget to sample the Current State podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on social media as well. Twitter, @KARCurrentState. Facebook, Current State from WKAR. Hope to see you Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.